All right, this is our second section in the section of main talks in this catechism class. I'm going to be talking tonight about what it is to be made in God's image. Last week we talked about the relationship in the Christian faith between faith, what we believe, and our dogma, and also the relationship between it and how we actually live, what we do. And we saw that there was an essential connection, and it doesn't do us much good if we live a good life but speak blasphemy, speak things unworthy of God, because we don't know the truth about Him, and we, you know, say whatever we imagine to say. It also doesn't do us a lot of good if we know all the truth about God but live an unclean life, unworthy of Him. And the two work off each other. Having the right teaching about God according to the revelation He's given us helps us deal with the God who really is, and they motivate us to seek Him and to, you know, truly encounter Him. They'll motivate us to purify our lives, as John says in his epistle, that we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. Remember that in his first epistle. And then the next verse says, "And he who hath this hope in Him purifieth himself, even as He is pure." If we have this hope of seeing Him as He is, and we have an understanding of who He is and what He is, this motivates us to purify ourselves so that we can truly, you know, rejoice in that appearance of His that we look forward to. In the scriptures, in a number of places, God sets before His people a choice between two paths. We see this in the case of Israel when Moses brought them out of Egypt. In Deuteronomy, as Moses winds down his farewell speeches and giving the next generation the law again, the new generation after the first generation had died in the wilderness, and the next one's getting ready to leave and go to the promised land, he recounts the law to them. And as he comes to the end of Deuteronomy here in chapter 30, he says, "See, I have set before you this day life and death." Well, life and good, death and evil. "I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live." In Joshua, we see that the choice is between serving God and serving the idols of the nations. Psalm 1, which we use frequently in the church, again, it suggests two paths. "Blessed is the man who hath not walked in the counsel of the impious, and hath not stood the way of sinners, and hath not sat in the seat of the pestilent." So there's this way of impious sinners and pestilent ones, but "his will is in the law of the Lord, and on his law shall he meditate day and night, and he shall prosper and be fruitful and will be well and firmly planted, whereas the impious are like the chaff which the wind blows away." Again, life and death, blessing and cursing. Or as Proverbs 14:12 says, "There's a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." So this choice is set before us as Christians, life or death, or as all human beings. As Christians, we're choosing life. But, you know, in the desert it was very dramatic. Here you have life or death, good or evil, blessing or cursing. And, you know, in what is it, Deuteronomy 28, which preceded this initial passage that we quoted, like in Leviticus 26, Moses had gone through an extensive list of blessings that would come upon the people if they were obedient to the covenant. I can look at them quickly, because God sometimes stoops to these kind of what we might strictly call mercenary motivations, you know, to get us to do the right thing, you know. And here he says, oh, if you're obedient, I will bless you. And so here are some of the blessings. Actually, the first 14 verses of chapter 28 of Deuteronomy are blessings, and then the last, how many verses are there? About 50 verses. The last 35, no. There are 69 verses, and the rest of them are about curses. So. But here are the blessings. When you cross the Jordan and come to the land the Lord your God gives you, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God to be careful and to do all His commandments I command you today, so be careful and do all His commandments, then the Lord your God will set you high over all nations of the earth. And it seems like there's a residual blessing on the Jews, because no matter where they go, no matter how they're oppressed, they always seem to prosper in a certain way. You know, they're always like a cat, they always land on their feet, it seems like, and they're usually among the elites in most cultures. We won't dwell on that, but the Lord will set you high over all nations, then all these blessings shall come upon you and find you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. So whether you live rurally or urban, in the urban setting. Blessed shall be the offspring of your womb, your children, and the produce of your ground, and the herds of your oxen, and the flocks of your sheep. Blessed shall be your storehouses and your reserves. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. You're out on business and your errands. May the Lord your God deliver your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face, and they shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. So they'll come organized against you, and then they'll be scattered in confusion. The Lord will command the blessing on you in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand in the land the Lord your God gives you. Pretty comprehensive blessing. The Lord your God will establish you as a holy people to Himself in the manner He swore to your fathers, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God and walk in His ways. Then all nations of the earth shall see you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. So the Lord your God shall increase you in good things, in the fruit of your womb, and the produce of your ground, and the offspring of your cattle, and in the land the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open to you His good treasure, the heaven, to give rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the works of your hands. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. Of course, our country is doing the opposite now. And you shall rule over many nations, and they shall not rule over you. So the Lord your God will make you the head and not the tail. You shall be above only and not beneath, if you heed the commandments of the Lord your God. I command you today to keep and do them. You shall not transgress any of the words I command you this day, to the right or to the left, to go after different gods to serve them. All right, so here's some motivation to keep the covenant. You want things to go well for you? You want to have the kind of life that you aspire to? Here's the path. Here's the path to life. Here's the path to blessing. Keep my commandments. Now, he goes on, and I won't read all of them, but he says, but it shall be, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep and to do all His commandments I command you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city and in the country. Cursed shall be your storehouses and your reserves. The food you store up for the winter, you know, probably the mice will get it, or the bugs will get in it, or, you know, won't be enough. Spoil. Cursed shall be the fruit of your womb and the produce of your land and the herds of your oxen and the flocks of your sheep. Cursed shall you be when you go out, and cursed shall you be when you come in. The Lord will send on you poverty, hunger, and consumption and all you set your hand to do, until He destroys you and lays you waste quickly because of your evil habits in which you forsook me. The heavens over your head shall be as brass, the earth under you shall be as iron. May the Lord give dust as the rain of your land. From heaven dirt shall come down on you until it wears you out and destroys you. So you're not going to have rain, you know, to have crops. May the Lord give you over to slaughter before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them and flee seven ways before them. You shall be in dispersion among all the kingdoms of the earth. You won't live in your land anymore. Your carcasses shall be food for all the beasts of heaven. The Lord will strike you with madness, blindness, confusion. You will grope at noonday as a blind man gropes in darkness. You shall not prosper in your ways. You shall be only oppressed and plundered all your days, and no one shall help you. You shall take a wife, but a different man will have her. You shall build a house, but you shall not dwell in it. You shall plant a vineyard, but shall not gather its grapes. You know, all this labor, and you get no benefit from it. A nation whom you have not known shall eat the fruit of your land and the produce of your labor, and you shall be oppressed and crushed all the days. And then it'll... And it keeps going.
Father.
And it gets worse. So, you know, but the motivation here is that they ultimately repent and return.
Yeah.
And we see this again and again in the Old Testament histories, as, you know, they fall away and they suffer, the Philistines or the Midianites or the Moabites or the Amalekites or somebody oppresses them and, you know, subjugates them, and they cry up to the Lord, and, you know, he hears them and he delivers them and he raises up somebody to rescue them. But anyway, do you still have a question, Sean?
Yeah, are these directly the commandments from God, or is it some things that Moses is telling the nation of Israel?
Well, the law was given by God to Moses and through Moses to the people. God originally spoke directly to the people. They didn't like to hear his voice, so they told Moses, you get it from God and give it to us, because, you know, we'll do it, but we just don't want to listen to God. We're scared. And God said, rightfully so. But yeah, this... I mean, our understanding is that, you know, God speaking through his prophet Moses. This way Moses referred to as a prophet, because he speaks God's words. There are plenty of modern liberal scholars who even question whether there was a Moses, you know, but that's beyond our purview here, really. So, all right. Jesus certainly thought there was a Moses. And if he doesn't know what he's talking about, then I don't know who does. So, but anyway, here's the context, you know, and then beginning of two chapters later, we have the word, see, I've set before you this day life and good, death and evil, blessing and cursing. And it's your choice. And so, you know, as people in this world, we have this choice. Everybody has this choice. And we all make it daily. Which way will we choose? The way that leads to life or the way that leads to death? And we may not even realize that that's what we're choosing between each day. But we see it all around us. We see people choosing ways that lead to death, and we see broken lives, you know, grief, sorrow, suffering, just a mess. You know, people have made a total mess of their lives. And, you know, and it's sad, you know, but again, they've chosen, for whatever reason, they've chosen a way that leads to death, that diminishes life, that crushes it, that snuffs it out. And it's not that God's actively out there punishing them for it. You know, our understanding is that, you know, God's the one who gives us life. He's the source of life. And if we choose to live without him, you know, we're created out of nothing, and we tend back to nothing without that source of life. And so we may have an existence, but we don't really have life. And, you know, it's kind of like, well... Yeah, that didn't work. Or as my own patron saint puts it, speaking about 20th century post-Christian Europe, he said Europe's just full of a bunch of walking corpses. They're alive, you know, but physically they're alive, but spiritually they're dead. They've rejected Christ. They've chosen the Enlightenment. They've chosen something else, you know, and they've rejected God. And, you know, we saw this, of course, in the communist revolution in Russia, and, you know, very conscious rejection of God, though they couldn't stamp faith out in the land. But we also saw probably unparalleled suffering and oppression by a government of a people, with millions and millions upon millions of people dead, and millions more, you know. You know, having their lives ruined because of some trivial thing they did that upset the communist authorities. And there's no objective rule of law, just the whim of the commissar and the very elastic criminal code that could be interpreted to apply to anybody. But, don't get me off on that. You're not, I'm getting myself off on it, so. But there's a way of life and a way of death, and we see this too in the Didache, which is also called the Teaching of the Twelve Apostles, which is a late first century document, which purports to be the teaching of the Twelve.
How do you spell that?
D-I-D-A-C-H-E. D-I-D-A-C-H-E. Didache. Or the Teaching of the Twelve Apostles.
First century?
Yes. I mean, scholars debate, but the consensus seems to be moving towards the end of the... towards the first century rather than later. An interesting document, but this document, this early, very early document, which after the New Testament, which is again purported to be the teaching of the 12 apostles, starts off with this very idea, the very first sentence. There are two ways, one of life and one of death, but a great difference between the two ways. And then the way of life then is this: first, thou shalt love God who made thee; second, thy neighbor as thyself; and all things whatsoever that wouldst should not occur to thee, thou also to another do not do. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or in this case, the negative form. What you don't want others to do to you, don't do to them. So like I'm constantly telling that to my children, and quickly they forget. And of these sayings, the teaching is this: bless them that curse you, pray for your enemies, fast for them that persecute you. For what thank is there if you love them that love you? Do not also the Gentiles do the same? But do you love them that hate? But do ye love them that hate you? And ye shall not have an enemy. Abstain thou from fleshly and worldly lusts. If one give thee a blow upon thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if thou shalt be and thou wilt be perfect. If one impress thee for 1 mile, go with him too. So on and so forth. Give to everyone that asketh thee, and ask it not back. For the Father willeth that to all should be given of our blessings, free gifts. Happy is he that giveth according to the commandment, for he is guiltless. Woe to him that receiveth, for if one having need receiveth, he is guiltless. But he that receiveth not having need shall pay the penalty. Why he received and for what? And coming into straits, he shall be examined concerning the things which he hath done. In the next chapter, the second commandment, the teaching, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not commit adultery, murder, pederasty, fornication, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not practice magic, shalt not practice witchcraft, murder a child by abortion, nor kill that which is begotten. Thou shalt not covet the things of thy neighbor, thou shalt not forswear thyself. We're told to flee every evil thing and every likeness of it, and given other ways that we're supposed to be. So in four short chapters here, we're given the way of life, kind of spelled out, and it's kind of a summation of Christ's commandments and teaching, and also that of the apostles. And then chapter 5 then talks about the way of death. And just one here, chapter is brief. And the way of death is this: first of all, it is evil and full of curse. Murders, adulteries, lusts, fornications, thefts, idolatries, magic arts, witchcrafts, rapings, I-N-E-S, false witnessings, hypocrisies, double-heartedness, deceit, haughtiness, depravity, self-will, greediness, filthy talking, jealousy, overconfidence, loftiness, boastfulness, persecutors of the good, hating truth, loving a lie, not knowing a reward for righteousness, not cleaving to good nor to righteous judgment, watching not for that which is good but for that which is evil. Think of the people, you know, our news is kind of like this. You know, our news always focuses on what's bad or what's, you know, we're going to be exposed to evil in the world. And, you know, how rarely do they send out a reporter to catch somebody doing something right, you know? let's catch somebody doing right and hold up somebody as a good example for others to follow, you know, and inspire people by it. I mean, that we, you know, we have this, you know, this curiosity about all things bad and evil, and of course it's fed, for that curiosity is fed in the media, but here it speaks of this is the way of evil, when we watch not for what is good but for that which is evil, whether it's in one another, you know, we look for each other's faults rather than our virtues, or whether it's in a broader scale. From whom meekness and endurance are far, loving vanities, pursuing requital, not pitying a poor man, not laboring for the afflicted, not knowing him that made them, murderers of children, destroyers of the handiwork of God, turning away from him that is in want, afflicting him that is distressed, advocates of the rich, lawless judges of the poor, utter sinners, be delivered, children, from all these. So, again, there's two ways, way of life and way of death. And, I commend the didache to you. Usually I hand it out at some points in this class. It's not long. It's just 3 or 4 pages here, but it's a very early monument and witness to what the early Christians past the New Testament period were actually doing and what they were teaching. It talks in here about baptism, about the Eucharist, about fasting on Wednesdays and Fridays, and these kinds of things, and how new Christians were received, and mentions bishops and deacons and so forth. Christians meet on the Lord's Day, on Sunday. And,
where can you get a copy of that?
Well, we have one in our library here, and it's online, Church Fathers. It's on, I think, Calvin College in Michigan has it online.
How much are they?
You can get the whole Christian Booksellers Distributors, or what is it, CBD. They usually have them for, I don't know what they're selling them for now, maybe $300 for 38 volumes like this.
That's not bad.
Sometimes it's less. I've seen it as low as $199, I think. So, but, yeah, 38 volumes. And it'll probably take a lifetime to get them right. But, 19th century scholarship translating all these works of Greek and Latin Christian fathers, and it's quite an accomplishment, really. All right, so we have a way of life and a way of death. We've talked last week about the relationship between correct doctrine or correct faith and the right way of life. Okay, I had a strange turn of phrase here that perplexed me. I think I was trying to be cute. Why does the path matter, the way of life or the way of death? I mean, it seems obvious, but we resist in our time this notion that there's a right way to go. We live in a time when... we're told that, it's popular to think that all roads eventually lead to the same destination. You take the high road and I'll take the low road and we'll both end up in Scotland. I'll just get there before you. According to the old song, that popular image of all the different religions are taking different paths up the same mountain and they get to the top and find the same being there. It's very, very common and very... it's just endemic now amongst us, and so to even say that there's one path, there's a right path and there are wrong paths, is probably considered intolerant and hateful or something like that. But again, this is the teaching of Scripture. This has been the teaching of the Church, and as Christians, we can't accept this that all paths lead to the same end. All the great religions ultimately worship the same God. So, is this path though that's laid out, this path of life, is just an arbitrary path? I mean, is it just, okay, God just gave these commandments because He wanted to give us some kind of commandments. He arbitrarily chose these and said, here, this is a test, you obey me and I'll bless you, and you disobey me and I'll curse you. I mean, could He have given us different commandments? Did it have to be the way He gave it, perhaps, we might ask. And I would say no. This is not an arbitrary path, dependent on some whim of God. Depends really on the very nature of who we are as human beings made in God's image and who God is. I mean, and to know the God who is. You know, we have to deal with him as he is. He doesn't change. He simply is who he is. And, you know, and he's not a, well, as C.S. Lewis puts it, you know, Aslan's not a tame lion. You know, our God's not a tame God, you know, if you want to, you know, push that too far. But, you know, his ways are far above ours, and he's thrice holy, he's a consuming fire. And so we have to approach him on his terms, not because he just wants to be harsh with us, but because he is who he is, and he's made a path for us. But this is the path, you know, it's like, what is it? My mind's not firing tonight. It's like, you know, if you want to, I don't know, you know, you want to go do service work in a nuclear reactor, you know, there's a way you can do that safely, and that's usually you have to follow all the protective procedures, put on the protective suit, you know, and, you know, and then when you come out, you go through decontamination, and finally you step out of the suit and all that to make sure that the dangerous stuff is contained and isn't spread and doesn't affect you. And, you know, it's not because the nuclear regulatory commission or whatever, you know, just wanted to be mean and nasty or make work for you. It's because that stuff in there can kill you. And if it gets out, it can kill a lot of other people. And so there's a way to deal with this safely and carefully and productively, so it heats our water and makes electricity for us and doesn't blow up and kill us all. And so, you know, the person working on a nuclear reactor knows this, and he's very careful. And he doesn't. Maybe he complains about what he has to do, but he knows that there's no other way if he wants to live. And it's similar with drawing near to God. You know, it's an arbitrary set of commandments that's given. It's to deal with a God who's a consuming fire and who's thrice holy. You know, here's the path. I've opened it for you. I've made a way for you to come to me, and here it is. And I set it before you, and you can choose. Do you want to follow it or not? And you know, and because, you know, I don't know if I want to say God is dangerous, but in a sense he is, because, you know, he doesn't change, and he doesn't change his essence to adapt himself to us. You know, it's like, you know the image I always use is, you have a room full of gasoline fumes. If you bring a match in there's going to be an explosion. I mean, there just is. That's what happens when you bring gasoline fumes in contact with fire. And a sinful person coming into the presence of God is like gasoline fumes in the presence of open flame. And that's just the nature of the beast. That's just the way it is. And so if we want to come near to him, we have to come on his terms, and we have to follow his procedures and follow his path. And this is what God's getting at in teaching the Israelites. You know, it's not that he's stingy or that he needs them. You know, I just need you to obey me, and because I'm the parent and you're the child, and, you know, you show me proper respect, I'll be good to you. I mean, he's teaching them. Of course, he's preparing them for the coming of Christ. But this has to do with the just the way it is between God and man. And so this comes out of our being made in God's image and likeness. So we see in Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the flesh of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image, and the image, which in the Greek is according to the ikona of God, kat ikona theou, the image in Greek is icon. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God he created him, male and female created he them. And so this is, we alone of all creation are made in God's image and have this commonality with him. In Romans 8:28, we're told, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image, again the ikonos, of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. You know, Christ is the image of the Father, and Christ is our prototype. He's the one that we're images to be images of him, and we're to be conformed to his image. And Christ is the firstborn among many brethren. He's the first, he's the God-man, he's the one who shows the way. He's the second Adam, the one who does correctly what the first Adam blew. and incidentally, you know, we'll get to that in a moment, I think. The first Adam, I'll get to it now. The first Adam was not, you know, he was without sin. He hadn't achieved the fullness of what God intended for him. You think about him, here's a man and a woman who had no parents. They were created out of nothing. In one moment they don't exist, in another moment they begin to exist and have life. They have no memory, no experience with their adult bodies, you know, adult human beings. Without sin, but you know, what do they know? You know, and so they're like grown children. And the fathers even use this image for them. They were like children in their knowledge and understanding. And so God put them in the garden, the paradise of plenty, as it's referred to, as a place for them to mature and for them to grow until they were ready to presumably go out into the earth and subdue it and fill it, you know, and be fruitful and multiply. And he just gave them that one initial test, you know, to, you know, not to eat of the one tree, which probably he would have let them eat later when they were ready. But, of course, we know the story. They disobeyed and they, you know, they wanted to be God without God. They listened to the serpent and transgressed. But Christ, again, succeeds where Adam fails and restores the kind of the lost image, if you will. We don't believe that the God image of God in us is ever really lost, but for man to really reflect that and enter into that image that God had intended for him was that why he was lost with Adam's fall. And Christ restores it, and he restores the image in us, and as he comes to each one of us. And so, anyway, we have some other passages here that relate to the image in us. Colossians 3:9 and 10, lie not to one another, seeing ye have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. So we've put on the new man, and we're being renewed in knowledge after the image or icon of him that created us. You know, he's the prototype, and we're being conformed to him. And as we have 1 Corinthians 15:49, as we have borne the image or icon of the earthly, we shall also bear the image or icon of the heavenly. And let's see, or 2 Corinthians 3:18. But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. So there's we're being changed into that image, but it goes from glory to glory. There's a progression, you know, from one level of light to another. And so there's a process involved. And of course, as we try to put on the infinite life, as finite creatures put on the infinite life of the infinite God, you know, there's, you know, I don't think we'll ever exhaust it. You know, there's going to always be a progression, you know. The kingdom, or heaven as people popularly call it, is not a static place. It's not a stasis. It's endless growth, endless development, endless, you know, pushing further and further into God. And so he's far better than the things that he's made. You know, all these things here in this world that we love so much and that give us so much pleasure, you know, they're a pale reflection of the goodness of God himself. Yet we hold to the things that he's made rather than to him, and don't see clearly where the true value is. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, Paul writes, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. So Christ is the image of the Father, and as I said, we're the we're to be conformed to the image of Christ. There's Colossians 1:15, Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, or the icon of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. And it's in this image that we're made, too. And this is a glorious thing, and this is why I always say it's really a blasphemy to, when we excuse our wrongdoings, to say I'm only human. Because to be a human is to be made in the image of God. To be a human is to be like Christ. That's what it is to be human. And that's a glorious calling. The fact that we don't live up to that, you know, to that degree, that we're not like Christ, to that degree we're not fully human yet. But don't ever curse being human. You know, we're going to be set above angels. Angels are not made in the image of God. We are.
What image are they made in? Just created beings.
Okay. Created beings. I mean, there's a rationality there. They're rational beings. We're not told that they're made in the image of God. You could read 1 Corinthians 15:35 to 58. I'm not going to take the time now to do it, but here's where it talks about, the earthly body putting on the spiritual body, you know, of us, you know, being transformed and putting on glory at Christ's second coming. The victory over death and so forth. But we could summarize by saying, like the seed that is planted dies and takes on a new form. You know, you plant a grain of wheat or an English pea in the garden, and it gets soft in the water, and it, you know, something green comes out of it, and pretty soon you don't even recognize what you planted, but a plant comes up and it bears fruit. So like a seed that's planted and dies, it takes on a new form. So we are planted in this earthly body and look forward to being raised, to growing into a spiritual body, bearing the image of the heavenly man or the heavenly God-man, Christ.
St. John puts it, what we shall be, it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You know, we'll be able to recognize ourselves and one another, but you know, it's not clear to us. But it'll be certainly better than what we experience now. St. John of Damascus, in his exposition of the Orthodox faith, discussing this notion of man being made in the image and likeness of God. This work was done in the 8th century, of the 700s. I think he died in 7 something. I don't remember right now off the top of my head. But he kind of wrote an exposition of the Orthodox faith, which kind of summarizes the dogmatic teaching of the Church. And this was after the Damascus had fallen to the Muslims and to the Arabs, and so he's living under Arab rule. But he wrote this great monument of theology. But in talking about this, he says, "Now this being the case, he creates with his own hands man of a visible nature and an invisible." So we have a body that's visible, but we also have a spirit or a soul that's invisible. And of course, modern psychologists who... psychology, which is supposed to be the word about the soul, you know, the field of study of the soul. Modern psychologists, many of them aren't even sure that we have a soul. You know, that's the irony there. But again, we understand that man has a visible nature and an invisible nature, after God's own image and likeness. On the one hand, man's body he formed out of earth; on the other, his reason and thinking soul he bestowed upon him by his own inbreathing. And this is what we mean by after his image. So this reasoning and thinking soul is, according to St. John, is what we mean by after his image. For the phrase after his image clearly refers to the side of his nature which consists of mind and free will, whereas after his likeness means likeness in virtue so far as that is possible. Okay. And St. Maximus is going to elaborate on this, so he wrote before St. John, a century earlier. If you can follow this, he explains this well. When God brought into being natures endowed with intelligence and intellect, He communicated to them in his supreme goodness four of the divine attributes by which he sustains, protects, and preserves created things. So we, having intelligence and intellect, have been given four of the divine attributes. Of the four, he granted the first two, being and eternal being, to their essence. So the fact that we exist belongs, you know, to be a human being means to exist. It's part and parcel of being a human being. Every human being exists. And also eternal being. Now, of course, we still experience death in this world, but Christ, through his resurrection, you know, he's trampled down death by death, and upon those in the tombs bestows life. And so death, everybody will be raised. Everybody will have eternal life. I mean, there's no soul sleep. There's no oblivion, no obliteration of being. You know, this is, when Christ rose, he imparted life to all. And, you know, by being joined to the human race in his own body, he imparts that life to the whole human race. He's like the leaven that leavens the whole lump, if you will. And so being and eternal being are given to all of us in our essence. But the second two, goodness and wisdom, these two divine attributes, goodness and wisdom, these belong to our volition, to our will, to our choice. So that what, it should be a he, what he is in his essence, God is in his essence, in his very being is goodness and wisdom, as well as being an eternal being and other things. But what God is in essence, the creature may become by participation. We participate in God's goodness and wisdom. We're not good and wise by just by our essence, but by choice. And by participation. This is why man is said to have been created in the image and likeness of God. He was made in the image of God's being, and his eternal being is in the image of God's eternal being, in the sense that though not without origin, it is nevertheless without end. So we all have a beginning. None of us is eternal going back. We all come into existence out of nothing at a particular point in time. But endless life is given to each one of us, without exception. It's part of just being human. Of course, in understanding this, we understand that the death that came upon Adam was a very unnatural thing for a human being. We were not made for that. And for man to have his soul separated from his body is doing violence to human nature. Okay, man is also made in the likeness of God, since he is good in the likeness of God's goodness and wise in the likeness of God's wisdom. God being good and wise by nature and man by grace. So every intelligent nature is in the image of God, but only the good and wise attain his likeness. And here's a distinction that many of the fathers make, is that, you know, we're all made according to the image. It's like you could say that all of us have the potential to achieve the likeness. It's by choice we choose it throughout the course of our lives, whether we're choosing life or death, you know, blessing or cursing. If we're choosing good and, you know, life and blessing, we're choosing to become conformed to the image of God, which is Christ, and we're putting on Christ. We're becoming good and wise by grace, and this is and there's one way, one formula has it. What the eternal Son of God is by nature, what he has in his very being and essence, you know, we're made this by grace. So we can understand now why St. Athanasius, for example, when he's on the incarnation of the Word, at the end says, you know, God became man so that man might become God. If we just hear this, we think, what does that mean? I mean, that's heresy or blasphemy or something. But again, if we understand it in this orthodox way, we'll never be God the way God is. There's always a separation because we're creatures. We're created. God simply is. You know, he is self-existent, self-sustaining being and needs no one and nothing. You know, he brought us into being, but what he has in his essence and his nature, this is what's given to us by grace. You know, it's grace that he makes us in the first place, I suppose, but then he chooses to impart these things. He gives us being an eternal being, but then he's willing to share his wisdom and his goodness with us if we want it.
if we choose life, if we choose the blessing. And so if we understand man being made in the image and likeness of God, as the scripture says, without holiness no one will see God, and blessed are the pure of clean of heart, for they shall see God. It's another passage in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. I'll kind of close with this, I think. We've heard this passage many times, but I want to point something out to you. As he winds down chapter 5 of Matthew, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy." And I don't think it ever said that in the law. That was probably a popular saying. "But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you." Okay, now why does he say this? Why are we to love our enemies and do good to those who do evil to us? Notice the reason he gives here. And this is the part we probably miss most of the time, or that doesn't jump out at us. "That you may be sons of your Father in heaven." Okay, that we may be sons. You know, we become by grace, by adoption, what the Son of God is by nature. The Eternal Son is Son of God by nature. He's a natural son. We become God's children by grace, by adoption. And how do we... So to love our enemies is to... The reason he tells us to do this, that we may be sons of our Father in heaven. And okay, let's go on. "For he makes his sun to rise on the evil and good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." Well, the point there is that God, who we're calling our Father by grace, by adoption, he loves his enemies. He sends rain on both the evil and the good, and makes the sun rise on the righteous and on the unrighteous. He pours out his blessings indiscriminately on the whole human race. And some give thanks, some acknowledge him, some enter into relationship with him, others take it all for granted and turn their back on him. This is of his nature. He is love, as John says in his epistle. God is love. And, he has no favorites, but those who seek him and open their hearts to them, in a sense, become like John, the beloved disciple. They enter into the love that's there. They're able to enter into it and participate in it and experience it, whereas those who stay away don't. That same love is there, available to all, but not all enter into it. But here the idea is that to become, what is it to be a son or a daughter of somebody? A natural son or daughter. It means that you're the product of, the union of your parents, that you share their genetic makeup, that you share their blood, and there's an inheritance there directly from them. And you do DNA testing, you can find out, you can confirm that these are the parents and nobody else can be. If we're to be children of our Heavenly Father, we have to become like him. We have to put on his character and put on his goodness and his wisdom, and part of that is loving our enemies.
A great example of that in the Orthodox way is that example he gives of Polycarp.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Praying for the soldiers who are taking
them
away
to arrest them, to take them away, feeding them at the table, mm-hmm. giving them food. And
yeah. Well, and there are many such examples, and an almost contemporary example, he died in repose in 1938, St. Silouan of Athos. He very important saint for us, I think. But again, one of those simple peasant-type saints. He was unremarked on the Holy Mountain in his time, but only a few saw what was there. But profound life and profound understanding of God. But he says that, that... Really, the acid test or the true proof of our Christianity is whether we love our enemies or not. That's the real proof. Whether we pray for those who mistreat us or whether we choose to curse them. Whether we choose to hate them, and whether we forgive.
and even go beyond forgiving, but even at least praying for them and maybe finding ways to do good to them. And you know, and this is how God is. So the more we become like God, the more we put this on. And so, you know, I submit that this, you know, that the path of life and the path of death is inherent in who God is and who we are and who we're made to be. And, you know, and this is just the nature of things. And because we can choose to accept it, or we can say, I don't like that, I want to create some other reality for myself and some other God. And God in His love lets us do that. He warns us, and He will probably send people to us throughout our life to try to pull us out of that delusion. But, you know, if that's what we want, He'll let us have it. But, you know. But anyway, our goal is to, you know, is to choose life, to choose blessing, to choose God, and to not only enjoy the being, an eternal being that He's given us, but also put on His goodness and wisdom. We not only have the image, but also we can be, you know, enter into the likeness and truly become His children by grace, you know, by character, you know, by character as children, not just a name, you know, but truly become like Him. And so we can say, yes, that's my child. And anybody who takes an honest look at us will say, yes, that is God's child. He acts like Christ, you know. And so, all right, any questions?